The fourth event in the Bozeman Public Library's Symposium Series was held on Wednesday, November 6, 2019, in the Innovation Hall in the Norm Asbjornsen Hall at MSU. The event featured a panel discussion about who's responsible for affordable housing. The panel featured guest speakers Dr. Corianne Payton-Scally, Andrew Jakubowicz, and Phil Rotherham, and it was moderated by Carmen McSpadden from Montana State University's Leadership Institute.
Good evening. I'm Susan Gregory. I'm the director of the Bozeman Public Library, and welcome to Symposium. We're very, very fortunate to have Symposium flourish in this community, and the reason this program has become successful is because of people like you. When we started brainstorming this project about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, our thought immediately was, this will work in Bozeman because this is a community of so many engaged people. So tonight's good evidence of that. Thanks for coming out on a cold evening. This is our fourth Symposium project, and our goal is to be a series every year that produces at least three programs tackling difficult, maybe controversial, hopefully timely topics. Tonight's topic, who's responsible for affordable housing? We're very fortunate also to have generous sponsors who make this program available. We're grateful to our Library Foundation for their underwriting this series and for a huge list of wonderful donors on the back of your program. Too numerous to list, but we're grateful to each and every one of you. And then again this evening especially, we are very grateful to the Montana State University for loaning or sharing this gorgeous facility with us. This is some of our first time out here, and what a beautiful building and what a gorgeous auditorium. So we're thrilled to be here. And thank you also to the MSU Leadership Institute and the Leadership Institute students under the guidance of Carmen McSpadden, who will be helping us this evening with the program. Our format follows the idea that is in some, I guess the one that comes to mind probably is the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, civil discourse programs that encourage people to ask really honest, candid questions, but ask them to do so in written form for reasons of civility and decorum, and so nobody hogs the microphone. So we're going to use that format this evening. This is the format for our series. And so I hope each of you have a card that you can write a question on or questions. And then if you have questions you would like for our speakers to address, please raise your hand and then pass them down. I think probably pass them to the end of the aisle. Is that the plan this evening, I think? Yeah. Our runners are going to go up and down these two aisles, and they will pick up those cards and bring them down, and our committee will sort those and share them with our moderator this evening. And so she will, in turn, take your questions and present them to our esteemed and wonderful speakers. If you'd like information about future programs, about Symposium, on the back of your card, please put your name and contact information, and we will get back in touch with you. Likewise, if you have some ideas for a program, if you have some thoughts about a topic that we should address, please put that on the card as well. Our goal is to be of use and of interest to the community, so your input is extremely helpful. Finally, what I'd like to do is introduce our wonderful moderator this evening. Our moderator this evening is Carmen McSpadden. Many of you probably know her. She's the director of the Montana State University Leadership Institute, currently president of the board of Headwaters Economics, and a governor's appointee to the Humanities Montana Board. She has a lot of accomplishments. Again, I can't take the time to list all of them now, but we're delighted to have her as our moderator. Please welcome Carmen. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. And we'll give a second for our guest to sit. And I want to thank the Bozeman Public Library and Susan for that kind introduction. Thank all of you in the audience for being here. I want to start by, again, welcoming you to Montana State University and to this hall, Inspiration Hall. And we hope that that will be part of our conversation tonight. This is a big, wide topic, and today we're very, very lucky to have some of the top experts in the country as well as our own Phil Rotherham as well, which is great, a builder and extraordinary in terms of the amount of affordable housing he has taken advantage of. It's hopeful for me to think about this with respect to the students that are in the audience, and you'll see the students of Montana State University here as well. I love the idea of it being on campus because those voices, those important voices of that generation, I hope will be heard through the Q&A, so I'm going to especially invite them to bring questions. So let's talk about affordable housing. We're hoping that we can walk out of this room tonight having demystified the idea of affordable housing, break down any points of confusion, and create a space for discourse, open to all ideas, new ideas, old ideas, challenges, and opportunities to be discussed. In short, we want to find ourselves discovering and exploring questions that matter. And those questions will come from all of you. And we want to make sure the conversation is open so that we can maybe grow some insight from places other than Bozeman. And that's why we have our esteemed guests with us that are from out of town. And then finally, where does the public sector fit into this question? So we're going to begin with our experts in the room so that they can shine some light on this. And so I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves, maybe a little bit about who they are. And the first question that will frame tonight's conversation is, what exactly is affordable housing? And I'd like to start with Phil.
Work? Yes. Thank you. I'm Phil Rotherham. I own a company called Rotherham Construction. I'm from here in Bozeman. I've been building buildings for 37 years. I focused on commercial and multifamily, and I've built upwards of 1,400 dwelling units that meet the affordable range. So it's a good question. What is affordable housing? I think it's different for everyone. There are plenty of definitions out there for affordable housing. All you have to do is look. The new, newly created plan that the city of Bozeman helped create sort of defines it as a function of area median income, referred to commonly tonight as AMI. So what part of the area median income does someone fit in, and is that an affordable housing designation? To me, it simply means if you can afford to rent or purchase a house without having a negative impact on the rest of your life, it's affordable. It's kind of the way I see it.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Andrew Jakovics. I head up the policy development and research team at Enterprise Community Partners. I'm based in Washington, D.C. We're a national nonprofit that works across the country, both delivering capital for affordable housing development, and I'll explain what that means in the context of what do we mean by affordable housing, as well as working with local partners on the ground to build additional capacity to develop affordable housing, think through public and private sector strategies for developing affordable housing and ways to access it. And then I sit on the research side trying to figure out ways to do it more efficiently and more effectively, trying to eliminate some of the rough spots in the systems, trying to align participants, bring stakeholders into the process, and figure out how to kind of do more, unfortunately, too many times with less, but certainly to sort of raise the quality of life for residents of affordable housing in community development situations. So what do we mean by affordable housing? So I agree with Phil's definition, right? That people should have housing that is affordable to them, and that looks very, very different for different folks based on their income and their particular circumstances. And that runs sometimes at odds with public sector programs that have particular program rules and particular income limits. And so one of the ways we sort of refer to things in shorthand is capital A affordable and then lowercase a affordable. And so capital A affordable are those units which meet certain criteria, have restrictions on rents or on prices if on the home ownership side, eligibility requirements for occupants, So those are the capital A programs for affordable housing. And then there's affordable housing, or housing that is affordable. When we say affordable housing, we don't just mean public housing. Quite often when people use the term affordable housing, your mind just immediately jumps to public housing, when there's in fact relatively little quote-unquote public housing or traditional public housing that exists. Most public housing is not owned by the public. It is privately owned and managed, but the occupants receive some public subsidy to make it affordable to them. And so that's in the broader conversation I think hopefully we'll have today. We'll cover both capital A affordable and lowercase a affordable, but I think it's really important to keep in mind that programmatically, we often mean one thing, but thinking about housing as a continuum, the same way we think about the occupants existing along a continuum, the same way that people aren't necessarily buckets of renters and buckets of homeowners, that people flow in and out of both of those circumstances over the course of their lives. I think kind of approaching this question and having that fluidity in the conversation while still being specific about what we mean in particular circumstances. So if you ask a question, we'll be as specific as we can be while keeping in mind sort of the broader goals of affordability. So
thank you. Corianne.
Hi, I'm Corianne Scally. I have personally about 20 years of experience in affordable housing practice and research. I have worked as a nonprofit housing developer. I have been a tenured professor in urban planning. I've worked at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Housing Service as a rental housing expert. And now I'm at the Urban Institute within our Metropolitan Housing and Communities Policy Center. The Urban Institute is a national nonprofit research organization based in DC, but doing work across the country to produce research that helps to improve outcomes for people and places. In terms of what is affordable housing, in addition to the definitions that we've already been presented with, I think that affordable housing is housing that is good quality and affordable to an individual or family at a price that they can afford without sacrificing other basic necessities. This includes things such as food, being able to pay for medical care that they need, child care, having a safe environment, and those types of things. I think just as important as the what is the who. Who are we talking about when we're talking about affordable housing? And we're really talking about a continuum of people, from people who may be part of a two-adult working household and family with children, to seniors who are desiring to age in place and maybe have a fixed income at that point in time. We're talking about people with disabilities, and we're talking about average people like you and like I in this room. But certainly people who earn less have the fewest options and are at the most risk for facing housing instability if there aren't options available for them in their community.
And Corianne, you just answered the first question, and keep them coming, which was who benefits, or maybe not, who benefits from affordable housing? Do you think we covered that fully? I think
I'm happy to let one of my colleagues add to that.
So I think that the benefits flow beyond just the occupants of the particular unit, that what it takes to make sort of complete communities, whole communities, is not just, you know, a bunch of high income earners, you know, sort of who exist in a bubble, right? There are retail workers, there are childcare workers, there are healthcare workers, there are doctors, there are lawyers, there are the whole gamut. We're in an engineering building, so I should probably mention some engineers. But it takes folks of all stripes to make healthy, vibrant communities. We actually know that mixed income communities often thrive, that children who grow up in those types of communities often do better in school than only high-income students, schools that only have high-income students. So thinking about the benefits of having affordable housing, housing where people can stay for the long term, as Corianne mentioned, in terms of housing instability, the flip side there is obviously housing stability. Thinking about ways to ensure that people can stay in the homes, that they've got those choices, that they can sort of have a range of opportunities and a range of options, I think is important, because those benefits accrue not only to the individual occupants who are able to readily afford their living situation without too much stress on their budgets, but the community as a whole really benefits from that as well.
I'm going to just follow up on that with an email that I received this week on affordability and the vision around being able to stay in Bozeman. I received this from a student this week, and it kind of sets the tone on what you were just discussing, Andrew, which is, I'll read the email. "Hello, Carmen. I recently invited a friend of mine to come with me to Symposium. I explained to him that the topic is about affordable housing and the conversations surrounding. He responded with something along the lines of, quote, good luck making affordable housing happen in this town, unquote. His remarks made me realize something. Affordable housing is an idea that seems to be an impossible dream. My question is, as a follow-up, what would you say to this student?
So, I guess by way of answering that, it's good that yesterday was election day, because we now know the results of certain elections. In Durham, North Carolina, the voters approved a $95 million bond at the local level to create more affordable housing in their city. I think Durham has a lot in common with Bozeman in terms of being a university town. It didn't just barely pass, it passed 76-24. So clearly there was sort of a groundswell of both recognition of need and a willingness to fund it locally. I think it takes, you know, conversations like these that sort of bring folks in from all walks of life to have conversations to sort of put the sort of onus on some level on the public sector, saying this is our public voice and we would like to see our resources and our commitment to this particular public policy challenge. So it's not easy. I mean, it's hard to build things. It's hard to preserve things. Conditions change. The economy changes. I mean, there's a lot of pressure externally from factors that you have little control over. The price of materials is not something that anybody can control at the local level. And so thinking about it from that perspective, really understanding what the levers that might be within your capacity to address, I think is important. But I think that the community coming together and saying this is a priority for us makes it easier to make the hard decisions about how to allocate public resources, how to bring in the private sector in a way that's beneficial, while respecting the fact that, you know, nothing happens for free. And so I think thinking about it that way, but really making sure that there is, you know, sort of broad consensus about the general direction in which to move, and then the specifics can get hammered out over time. So I think the planning process that the city's been going through, we saw a preview of it earlier today, I thought was actually incredibly comprehensive and really thoughtful. So I think actually, as people learn more about that, I think that mindset might change, that I think there is reason to be optimistic about being able to tackle it. Doesn't mean it's going to be solved immediately, but I think you can make meaningful progress if you're kind of clear about your objectives and the commitment to seeing it through.
Thank you. And Phil? And what would you say to that student as well? And following up?
I'd say absolutely you can find a place to live here. Absolutely. And there will be more. There's no reason to think that we won't be providing more affordable housing. And affordable to whom is the question, really. Is it affordable to a new MSU student just graduating, perhaps? Well, I have a whole office full of MSU graduates that have made it here and are doing fine. I have some very young ones who are just out of college, and I have a lot of construction engineers who are older. So I do think that's going to happen, and I think that there are different types of housing that will become available. I know that's a fact. I know in the pipeline of housing there are a lot of rentals coming on board, and some of them will be created in the low-income housing tax credit program, which will provide low rents if you qualify. I believe that there will be efforts made to make headway into what they're calling that missing middle group of housing, where people that make a little bit more money have a little bit equal to or greater than the AMI are going to find that there's going to be new product available. It's not going to come easy, and it may not happen right away, but I do believe very much that affordable housing for not only students but people emigrating here from elsewhere, it's becoming available. It's going to be out there. I'm aware of a project, for instance, that's calculated to be to provide 120 senior units and 125 family units coming up in 2020. So if you qualify there in that program, that's affordable housing. So I think there's a lot to be done. I do think that that's the low-hanging fruit, though, of affordable housing is that LAHTC product, because it does have a debt and equity relationship that's about 50-50, so there is a large equity portion that is going to help bring the cost down to the end user. I'm thinking that the new housing action plan is going to create a pathway for it was a job well done by those who created it. I think it's going to create a pathway to figuring out the next step in the process. And that step is one, of course, I'm very interested in. That step is taking it from a theoretical plan on paper and actually building it, making it happen. So.
Thank you. Would you like to add to anything, Corianne? Okay. Phil, I'm going to just stick with you on this one, and then Corianne, if you will bring your point of view from a national level, that would be great. This question is, it would seem that the best way to end the affordable housing crisis would be to build many more houses until supply outpaces demand. Please comment on this theory.
That's absolutely true. Because we have a lack of supply, it continues to drive price up. Only until we are oversupplied and there are choices will prices come down, at least in our economy here, in my opinion. So how do we get there from here is the question, because right now the prices of land, the costs of land are high enough that it makes it difficult to provide lower cost housing. As Andrew said, materials are, pricing is not controlled here. Most materials that go into homes are national commodities, except for concrete. We make concrete here. We have the natural resources for concrete locally, but everything else comes in here in a truck or a train from somewhere, and the pricing of it is affected by the national commodity, the national use. We don't, the amount that we use here in our town has no effect on price. So yeah, how do you get that supply built up so that it outstrips demand? Because right now, demand is greater than supply.
Thank you.
Great. So I definitely think building more is important and helps. But there's two parts of a housing transaction. There's what the housing costs, and there's what you can afford to pay. And I do think we've seen incomes significantly lagging behind the increase in housing costs across the country. So I do think that there's an income component here as well. If you think about, say, minimum wage and how that has or hasn't grown over time, and you think about a household where there are two minimum wage earners working, their incomes just are not going up quickly, we just need to be mindful that building just any supply at any price point isn't necessarily going to reach that family with minimum wage earners without helping them boost their incomes as well.
So, Andrew, any follow-up on that?
Sure. Yeah, I think I'm just sort of building off what Karen was saying, that I think it's really important to recognize, right, that in sort of pure economic theory, right, sort of if you add supply at the top, it sort of filters down and becomes more affordable, but that process takes a long time, right? Housing that's older is typically more affordable, but you can't build old housing today. And so thinking about producing housing across a range of price points is really important because, yes, more supply will in theory, lower prices at some point, unless you're also inducing demand, right? Getting folks coming in. We were chatting in the green room about the fact that there's $600,000 houses, and if you're in Bozeman, you're looking at a $600,000 house, you're like, that's insane. And if you're flying in from Chicago, you're like, hey, it's a bargain, right? And so thinking about kind of who's occupying and where those people are coming from to buy these houses, and making sure that you're actually able to produce at a range of price points, not just at the top, hoping that that has then sort of beneficial effects lower down to cascade downwards. So thinking about it from that perspective, I think, is important, so that we're producing not only sort of market rate housing, both on the rental side and the ownership side, but really also producing housing that is affordable to certain segments of the population from day one. And whether that's through the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program, that was mentioned earlier, or with other, sometimes public resource coming in subsidy, with other ways to kind of lower the cost of housing and keeping it affordable over the long term, not just sort of it's affordable today and then the rents go up tomorrow and it's no longer affordable, but really being strategic about producing at a multiple level of prices, I think is really important.
Okay. So a big piece of this we've been talking about that's coming down the pikeway, and this is makes this conversation so valuable right now, is the Housing Action Plan, which will be presented to the Commission on November 18th. And so some of these questions I'm seeing have maybe a question and a point of view around a strategy. So here's one that follows along the same discussion, which is, since population growth drives up rent and housing costs, should entities that encourage and promote growth bear an extra cost in providing affordable housing? For example, MSU, Chamber of Commerce, Gallatin Association of Realtors. Woo! So again, the question I'm going to read again. Since population growth drives up rent and housing costs, should entities that encourage and promote growth bear an extra cost in providing affordable housing?
So definitely there's a trend across the country of anchor institutions, often referred to as EDs and MEDs. So definitely Montana State and places like Bozeman Health would fall into those categories. Of these types of institutions, thinking a bit more carefully about their role within the community and how they can help the communities around them thrive. And so we have seen them. We have seen examples of hospitals, for example, investing in surrounding communities through homeownership programs, buying vacant properties, and helping to rehab them and sell them to lower-income homeowners in the community. So there are certainly models out there of anchor institutions and then other employers as well, thinking about how to attract and retain employees by offering things like employee-assisted housing programs, where maybe they would help with, say, down payment assistance for employees who come and work for them. So I think there are a lot of examples to look at where we do see people who are in some ways driving population growth as employers, as well as institutions of higher education, trying to contribute more to the community.
Okay. I think in some cases, businesses are actually short of employees here in our community. I think they're in several areas of our economy, we actually need more people. For example, skilled tradesmen comes to mind for me. So some companies may want to voluntarily or find it to their benefit, their own corporate benefit, to dig in and find a way to participate in providing housing just for the good of their own company, and maybe they feel good about it too. But I think that's probably a good thing to do. I don't think it can be required without some study. The Affordable Housing Plan calls it a nexus study. Andrew, you probably know more about that than me. Corianne, you too. But if you look at that plan and you read the goals and objectives and the roles and responsibilities and the things that they look the authors looked at to create the document. One of them is termed commercial linkage, and I believe what that is all about is that companies that are growing be in some way required to provide something to be determined towards affordable housing. But I know that's not, you can't just snap your fingers and make that happen.
So, and I'm going to throw this to Andrew with respect to that Nexus study. If you could say a little bit about that and maybe tie in this other question here, which is how might MSU or other universities, maybe you have some experience, either of you, work with their cities to bolster efforts towards affordable housing? What steps should they take?
Sure. So there are a number of places that have implemented these linkage fees, not necessarily related to kind of per employee or from sort of induced population growth that you could sort of estimate, but as a function of sort of a small fee on the construction of new commercial space. And again, that's sort of a way to, and it usually flows into a fund, which can then be drawn down to build more affordable housing, not necessarily different than things like tax increment finance districts and the like. There are other sort of a number of mechanisms by which things like that have been employed in other communities. But I think sort of directly linking it to population growth might be a bit challenging. There's sort of organic growth of the population, right? People have kids, those kids grow up, and if you want to see them stick around, you don't necessarily want them on your couch in perpetuity. So they're going to need housing too, and so they're also going to need to be educated, et cetera. So I think there's a balance that you want to strike between what are the sort of, again, the kind of normal costs that a community incurs to encourage its own vitality without necessarily sort of squelching that growth and that sort of feeling that there's a place that it can grow and people can all find a place within that community. Specifically to the question about what universities have done, if there's underutilized land that's controlled by the university, thinking about both making sure that, you know, sort of in the more narrow context, students have the opportunity and the option for on-site housing, dorms and the like, so that way the sort of the rental stock in the broader community isn't occupied as frequently by students. Someone mentioned today there's basically like a 1% vacancy rate in rental housing in Bozeman. That's not sustainable, right? I mean, that's why rents skyrocket, just because there's just tremendous capacity for landlords to keep pushing prices until people finally break. And then people double up and things like that. So making sure that there's enough on-campus housing, I think, is really important. But then thinking also about the employees of the university. Are they adequately housed? You know, not necessarily, you know, tenured faculty who can probably go out and buy their own homes, but really thinking about junior faculty who often don't get paid very much, thinking about custodial staff, support staff, and the like. What are the housing options that are really available to them currently, and is there a way the university can produce some housing, right? That's clearly, you know, we're sitting in a lovely new building, right? They have real estate development capacity. Can some of that capacity be put towards developing residential properties that they would potentially control, right? So it can be a profit-making or at least a break-even venture on their side, particularly if they already control the land, right? Land prices are not trivial part of the total development cost, and if you can remove that line item from the calculus, the opportunity to make housing much more affordable is there. And so I think, you know, thinking about universities, but also thinking about other civic institutions that are community-based, hospitals are another example, but also thinking about faith-based institutions. We're doing some work now around working with faith-based institutions that have underutilized parcels, vacant properties, parking lots that really sit dormant most of the week. Are there ways to kind of put those to much better use, potentially for affordable housing, for community services, and thinking about ways to really unlock land at relatively low cost, I think is a really powerful way to potentially bring more supply online at lower price points.
Thank you. So this next group of questions is around housing and subsidies and taxes. So I'll try to loop it into one question. How can Bozeman grow and provide affordable housing without increasing taxes on existing residents? Which ties into the question that someone asked about without subsidies. So again, this is a question around taxes and affordable housing.
I think that's a really good question. You know, I think something that's come across already from kind of the different definitions of affordability that we've presented is, you know, there's a specific sliver of folks kind of at the bottom end of the income spectrum that really need assistance in paying their rent. And I think that's something that can be addressed. There are definitely programs out there to address that. I know there's also a great volunteer effort here in Bozeman to help assist folks who are really just struggling with a lack of income. And I think that there are a lot of opportunities and programs that are already out there to assist folks who are slightly higher up on the income bracket and need a little less financial assistance, maybe just a boost of some kind. Maybe it's just reducing the cost of entering home ownership, for example. They make enough to sustain it, but maybe they need some assistance in getting that savings for that down payment. So I feel like there are already a lot of opportunities out there, and that it wouldn't, you know, it doesn't have to take much or much extra to really help the folks who really need a more substantial financial assistance at the bottom rung of the income bracket.
So the question of how can we build housing without raising tax, I think that's an interesting question. Right now, I'm not sure that there's ever been a bond floated for affordable housing in Bozeman. I don't think I've ever remembered that in since I've lived here anyway. So private development needs to be incentivized to build affordable housing. Way back in the 80s, that low-income housing tax credit program was created, and that's what that did. That incentivized private developers to build affordable housing, and it still works today. So that can continue. That doesn't cost us, theoretically, tax directly. I mean, the federal government is giving away tax credits. They're allocating tax credits to private developers. So I guess you could play that backwards and figure out somehow we're paying a little bit towards that. But it's not a direct tax by any means. Mm-hmm. So I think nonprofit and for-profit developers need to get their heads together and figure out how to build more product. And if you take the time, perhaps you've already read through the very good document that the consultants the city hired put together, you'll find that they have some very lofty goals in there. And they're not easy to get. Some of them are easier to get to than others, like I mentioned earlier. One of them that's not too easy to get to is what they call the missing middle. And so in the missing middle, there are people who make approximately 100% of the area median income, and yet there's no housing for them. And why is that? Well, what is the solution? Why is there no housing built there? It's because it can't be. You can't build and sell and live and have a company if everything you're selling is less than market or even less than cost. It doesn't work. So I think that there are ways to attack that. I know there are. I've thought of a couple of ideas that we could bring to the table. Many others smarter than I have done the same, for sure. So I don't think we have to pay additional property tax, or we don't have to levy a bond, float a bond and levy a 19 or 20 year payback. I don't think you really need to do that. I think we can make progress without that, but if you want to make progress really fast, sure, it takes a lot of money. That raises a lot of money.
So Phil, back to you. So mm-hmm. What? Share an idea. Share one of those ideas that you know.
I'll share two.
Share two of those ideas.
Save your money for the next downturn. In 2009, where's Heather? 2009, we built phase two of the West Edge condominiums for a price that is less than half of what it would cost today. Because there was a downturn in the economy, there was no work, everyone nationally, locally, and regionally were competing. The price of materials went way down because nobody was buying them across the country. The price of local subtrades went way down because they were trying to just stay in business. Save your money until the recession and buy cheap land. When land prices go down, and they do, save up, put it in the bank, land bank. That's one thing. Another thing that's not new at all, and I can't take credit for it, is if there could be a larger developments built. Larger developments get a little scale in savings, particularly if there was a way to have that land banked and create attached product. Single family detached homes cost more than an attached product in our town. Townhomes, if you can find the right land to build significant numbers of them, would be a good way to go. Townhomes are easier to sell than condos because you can get a traditional mortgage on a townhome. So I think those are two ideas that we need to keep in mind. And I think that's makes sense to me.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's keep these ideas going.
Advocate for the federal government to fully fund its programs. Only 1 out of 5 renter households that qualify for federal housing assistance receive any. And that's just the case everywhere across America. And so if you stop and think about that, you know, at some point the federal government made a commitment that it was going to really be there and help people, particularly renters at the lower end of the income spectrum. And the reality is that they don't allocate enough resources for all of those families and individuals who are eligible. So that's definitely something that you can be a part of. Now, it's not just the responsibility of the local community to care for your neighbors, but it's really the responsibility of the country as well.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to another question. You talked, and as I read your bio, you have some deep expertise in the rental market. And this question, this is a great question. In the broad, quote-unquote, sharing economy, is the social stigma associated with renting dissipating? In fact, is renting the new black? And how does this tie into what we're talking about tonight?
Yeah, so there's definitely kind of an ongoing debate within research today on why are millennials not becoming homeowners at the same rates as their parents? And, you know, there's research that points to things such as the recession, points to things such as depressed incomes compared to rising housing costs as definitely reasons for the kind of delay in home ownership right now. But I do think that there is also a sense of renting becoming destigmatized and more okay. Definitely you hear things about new co-housing movements, new types of living spaces and shared living spaces, particularly in very hot housing markets, such as San Francisco, for example. And I definitely think that there is a movement kind of within younger generations to embrace renting as more than just kind of a necessary step and in life towards homeownership, and see that more as a long-term strategy for promoting mobility, for example, giving you options, allowing for change. And I definitely think we've seen a bit of a shift among younger generations in that regard.
There's two wonderful questions from our audience that are tied to young people, looks like. I don't think I'll ever be a homeowner. What needs to happen to change a young adult's view on homeownership? How can the city of Bozeman support the abilities of young people and growing families to buy homes? And I'm going to tie this kind of crazy tax one into it, which is, could we have a tax on second homes and investment properties so that it makes it more equitable for people in Bozeman to buy homes?
So it's really interesting, right? So Karim talked about some of the research that's going on, the conversations that researchers have, and it's one of these things that the answer will only kind of become clear over the course of time. But it's really interesting because if you look, Fannie Mae does a regular, I think it's a quarterly survey of home buyer sentiments or household sentiments about home buying. And the percentage of people who say, at some point in the future, I do want to buy a house, has remained relatively stable through the Great Recession, through today, even as, obviously the demographics have shifted, and so there are more millennials responding to the survey. But it's about delaying home ownership, and I think for a variety of reasons. One thing that has come up in a number of other research studies is the role of student debt, which is far, far higher today than it has been in the past. And the way student debt plays in, it plays in two different ways. It's sort of student debt by income has, we'll get technical, it's bimodal, right? So you've got sort of two large bumps with sort of not much in the middle. On one end, you've got folks with very, very high levels of student debt who have that student debt because they've gone through graduate school and have very, very high earning potential. And so that student debt will likely go away in due time and is not necessarily an impediment to home ownership at some point in the future. On the other end of the income spectrum, you've got people who got into student debt and never finished a degree, whether it was an associate's degree, 2-year college, 4-year college, whatever, and so are saddled with the debt but don't have the earning potential. And that's a cohort that I think we need to be particularly concerned about, who are likely to persist as renters for some time because the student debt will be just too much to bear to also take on the burdens of home ownership. But thinking about that more broadly, getting back to the sharing economy question, mm-hmm. right, is that that gets into the sort of the starter home and families. People have also delayed coupling, delayed children longer than previous generations. And so, again, some of that is just a function of economic uncertainty coming out of the Great Recession. But there does seem to be a shift in social patterns such that on the development side, large national builders have basically done away with producing entry-level homes, and they've basically smushed together sort of starter homes and move-up homes into kind of basically move-up homes and at the move-up price point, because from their perspective, if you've already got several kids before you're ready to buy your house, right, we're not going to build, a 3-bedroom house. We'll build 5- and 6-bedroom houses with 2-car garages or 3-car garages, right? So the average size of houses that are being produced is larger today than it's been in the past. So that all sort of flows into what's available for sale. And so even though this was sort of started off as a demand side question, part of it also has to do with the supply that's available, thinking about it from the home purchase side. So I think it's sort of a multifaceted problem that doesn't have a single answer to it. But I do think that figuring out how to get folks potentially into ownership situations sooner is broadly beneficial because it means that the demand on the rental side goes down, which is where we're seeing a lot of the pressures coming, particularly for folks who are lower income who have to then pay sort of higher rents because of the rest of the push in the market. But then the other thing to consider is sort of urban versus suburban living. And there's a premium put on urban living, right? So 20, 30 years ago, sort of, I guess, pre-Friends is sort of partly the dividing line, right? But Friends sort of made cities cool again, and now cities are like the place to be. And so it's not clear that even if you've got households living in urban situations, living in urban environments, that when they decide to become homeowners, right, or when they decide to move from renting to owning, that also translates in a desire to move from an urban, mid-rise life, sort of style to a suburban lifestyle. And so we might see actually transition of rental buildings into condos to allow people to both own and stay in cities, which isn't adding to the supply. And what it does do is it potentially takes rental units off the market. And so I think there's going to be an interesting dynamic in that space if we're not producing more in-town housing. And we're sort of relegating new construction only out on the edges, that the demand may actually still be in town and therefore keeping prices high because we're not producing housing not only of the type that people want, but also in the places that people want. So I think we need to be thoughtful about that from that perspective too. Mm-hmm.
So this takes a little bit of a curve with respect to this question. So experts, and maybe it's pointed to the two of you as well as, I guess it's this issue around experts have determined the bar to minority owning houses is not income, but capital or savings to make the initial down payment. So now if we could talk a little bit about that, and this, and perhaps a broader issue across the board. Is there a solution regarding income and wages and the ability to save with respect to minorities? But I guess we could broaden that question a little bit, too. It's a great question.
So as the rental housing expert in the room, maybe not the best person to answer this in detail, but you know, I think that it's not just savings, because there are definitely a lot of low down payment or no down payment programs out there. It's also credit. So I think we have a credit crisis in our country, and in that we have certain households that just suffer from poor credit. And there's a lot of reasons for that, including they may not have had the opportunity to build a credit record, and this is something especially students in the room should pay attention to. You know, there are certain payments you make on debt that count towards a credit score and showing a lender that you are credit worthy for a mortgage. And then there are certain things you do, like pay your rent on time, for example, that do not actually count and build your credit score. And so I think we see folks who are getting overlooked and underrated for their credit, and therefore not found to be eligible or basically to be too high of a risk for lenders, even if they have a perfectly good track record of paying a lot of bills on time. So I think that that's definitely a crisis that we're facing in our country. And I think that some of the credit score agencies, I think FICO, for example, is trying to come out with a new scoring process where they might include things like rent payment history in calculating people's credit to enable people who right now are kind of shut out of the mortgage market to be able to be considered the creditworthy risk that they are.
Okay. I think that being a good borrower is really important. I think that's part of the credit quality discussion that we're hearing right now. We got into a lot of trouble back in 2007 and 8 and 9 with extending credit to people that weren't good borrowers. I think we have to be mindful of that as we go forward. And I think also that it's very true that the down payment there are programs out there to help that, but I know young people who can't make the down payment but could certainly make the monthly payments. And one other and quick finish to that is I have two millennial children, and they bank online, and they don't ever go to a bank. They avoid that as much as possible. They do everything. They pay their bills online, some like many of you may as well. I think you need to go in there and strike up a personal relationship with a banker. I think that goes a long way. If you go in and you create a relationship face-to-face and you get recognized and you build your credit quality up by making your payments on time and you have that relationship, I think that's really important for all people, not just for people in business.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the down payment sort of the wealth question is really, the research is pretty clear, right, that there are very, very large disparities between minority wealth and white wealth, particularly as a function of home ownership, which is really the largest driver of wealth for most American households. Black home ownership rates are below where they were in the mid-90s. And part of the problem was not just getting into homes, but then sort of refinancing sort of predatory behavior by lenders, basically stripping equity from the property, very high fees to refinance with teaser mortgages and things like that. So any value that potentially was created and wealth they might have gained got then stripped away in the process of sort of financial churn. So just sort of putting that out there, that the loan products that are available today are not the ones that existed pre-crisis, which is a good thing, that the Dodd-Frank reforms have really done a lot to make sure the sort of the rise of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, although now it's the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, but CFPB, as most of us still call it, has really done a lot to protect consumers and ensure that mortgage products are good. Part of the problem, though, is that the housing finance system is still very much constrained. Some of Coran's colleagues at the Urban Institute really do some great charting of the housing finance system and sort of credit availability. And the what's called the credit box, so think about FICO scores, really are much, much higher today than they've been in the past. And not really for any good underlying reasons around credit, but it has to do with a whole bunch of other structural and systemic challenges. I'm happy to opine on that later. I don't want to get us too far off topic. But just thinking about ways to kind of make sure that credit is flowing and that it's flowing into communities of color in particular is really important. The Community Reinvestment Act is really important in that regard, making sure that lending takes place in heavily minority and in the high poverty neighborhoods. Is really important to ensure that people can go in and can get access to credit. And I think, you know, to Phil's point about kind of striking up a relationship with a banker, that works when the banks still have branches in your community. In a lot of cases, because of the prevalence of online banking, banks are sort of retrenching a little bit. So to the extent that you do have bank branches and can go in and sort of strike up those relationships, it's really important. But even if you bank online and you are making the types of payments that Corian has mentioned that, you know, don't typically flow into traditional credit histories and credit scores, so you basically either you're basically a thin file, as they refer to it, so you sort of it's just hard for them to make lending decisions. Both Equifax and TransUnion are starting these partnerships with some of the larger apartment owners to begin reporting rents. Because if you're making a rent payment that is as high or potentially even higher than your mortgage would be, right, it's sort of crazy that that shouldn't count. But yet it doesn't flow in. The only time it flows in is when you fail to make your payment and then they report you to the creditor. So all the negative stuff appears on your credit history, but the fact that you have otherwise been a very good credit, you know, sort of a good customer never sort of makes its way in. Equifax actually now, I think, it lets you go online and sort of say, hey, please look at all these other payments that I'm making, my cell phone bill, my insurance bill, et cetera. And so that way you can start to build up a more complete file. Because in a lot of cases, people are kind of on the cusp of home ownership. The problem is not that they don't have a credit history. It's just that the credit history is too small or too thin for the lender to be able to kind of run the FICO score process. So that's sort of part of the problem. And folks are interested in kind of that particular aspect. I would recommend also looking, there's an organization called the Credit Builders Alliance that's doing a lot of work, particularly around kind of getting rent reporting into credit scoring. So it's worth further investigation on that front.
Great. So the other side of that, which I think if we could just take a minute more on, is wages. And so a question that is certainly near and dear to a growing community, and I'm going to tie a few of these together, is wages for construction workers increase so workers can afford to live here, which drives up the cost of housing. But what about those of us whose wages are not increasing? One thing we've seen here is a growing chasm between wages and the cost of housing. Is this a wages problem, a market failure, or something else? In other words, where is the money going today that it hasn't in the past? And let's just see if you can tie this in. Do you believe housing is a human right? And that's for you, Phil.
Anyone here from the philosophy department? Mm. You could take that question. I'm going to avoid that question because I don't know the answer.
Okay.
The rest of the question, and you need to sort of repeat. You just kept going, and I just kept following, and I don't know if I really have the answer you're looking for.
I think it's summed up that We have this building going on, and we have our wages increasing in the construction field. That was the first one. Yet, I'm not a construction worker, and my wages are flat in this town.
There's a great demand for construction work right now. Because of that great demand, there is a great demand for people to do that work. To get people to do that work is hard in our community. They're not all here. As I said earlier, there's a lack of skilled tradespeople. On some of our larger projects, I have 272 apartments under construction right now. And I have people from Minneapolis. I have people from Salt Lake. I have people from Idaho. I have people from Kansas. So we have subcontractors traveling here, taking up housing, by the way, when they get here, to do work in Montana. If there's not a demand for your job, you may not get a raise. But for me, and I, when I have to go out and look for people that are very high-quality people with a high construction IQ and great experience, the marketplace is going up for that person. Mm-hmm. And a sidebar to that, when the marketplace goes up and you do hire that person, that puts upward pressure on the rest of your wage structure, or it can put upward pressure on the rest of your wage structure. You know, the new guy getting the most money doesn't always work. So in our industry, yes, wages have gone up to a degree. I can't speak for really very well for other types of businesses that may have a little bit more stagnant wage growth, but it does drive the price of buildings up, for sure. It has to.
Thank you.
Stagnant flat wages are definitely an issue, and you know, I think that is one thing that makes the case for the need to have a variety of housing options at a variety of price points available in the community, because it really just depends on the sector that you're working on and whether you're going to see those wages rise or not, or how quickly they'll rise. And meanwhile, as the question noted, housing prices keep going up. So I think that's a great argument for ensuring as a community that you have a variety of options available at different price points so that people can afford the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. So this is a question about Gallatin Valley in particular, but you may have some more national examples. Gallatin Valley has seen a spillover as people look for more affordable living in places like Livingston, which is over the hill, and Belgrade down the valley. How can these communities partner to ensure stability with the increase in housing demands? So have you seen communities that were dealing with lower levels of housing, affordable housing crises? How have they partnered with communities that are nearby? What has been some of the strategies that these cities have used?
So there are a number of places that have sort of, rather than doing their planning at the municipal level, have taken a regional approach. And so kind of allocating, kind of figuring out what the sort of aggregate responsibility is and then sort of parceling it out back down to the individual communities. And so approaches like that sometimes work, sometimes don't, to be honest. But sort of recognizing that different communities can offer different things to the region, and that the region as a whole, right, is sort of probably healthier when all the parts kind of interact with each other and can really sort of create kind of a centralized vision for the way the entire region is going to operate, as opposed to, you know, sort of Bozeman going by itself and, what were the other places? Livingston and Belgrade are kind of doing their own thing, right? Because if the jobs are going in one community, but it's still affordable someplace else, right, then you're going to start seeing migration to those more affordable places. And then going back to the jobs question and the wages question, right? So then what do you have to pay me to now make me commute back into Bozeman if I'm sort of, you know, particularly if I'm in a lower wage, lower skilled job, right? Why would I commute all this direction back, you know, back into Bozeman if I could get the same, you know, sort of entry level job at, you know, a retailer, right? So there's a, you know, an Old Navy in Bozeman. There's an Old Navy where I am in Livingston. Why would I commute in to Bozeman, right? So that's actually, you know, you'd end up seeing wages rise in Bozeman to have to bring those workers back in. So thinking about sort of the jobs market and the search patterns, I think if people sort of, that's one of the reasons why you want to kind of come up with some of these regional strategies, because you want to make sure that not only is housing sort of broadly affordable, but that the growth patterns are kind of manageable across all of these places, and that the economy, right, again, these economies are not happening in isolation, right? I mean, Phil's talking about bringing folks in from halfway across the country for these kinds of jobs, but even thinking about other jobs where the demand may sort of wax and wane in a much over a much smaller geography, making sure that there's sort of a broad regional understanding of the way those economies are interacting, I think is really important.
Corianne, is there a way to be able to forecast or predict housing pressures in a community?
I think forecasting housing need can be a bit more of an art than a science. Definitely there are ways to do it, but I think as already noted, there's an economic cycle that, you know, we can kind of expect cycles of growth, cycles of recession, you know, or even just more mild downturns in the economy. And I think that the jobs certainly drive the housing need often. And so I think there's definitely an element of knowing that something is going to happen and come down the road, but not necessarily knowing how much or when. That can make it very challenging. It's definitely worthwhile, though, to pay attention to trends over time and to try and forecast them out and see if you can be prepared for those cycles when they happen.
Thank you. Phil, this one's for you. You talked about the Housing Action Plan, and within that plan is 5,800 affordable housing units needed by 2025. You talked about some ways, a couple pearls that we can do right now. What other ways do you believe can help the process of affordable housing to be sped up?
I think we need to back up for a second. If you look at the plan, they say that there is a need for between 5,400 and 6,340 new homes in the next 5 years. 60% of those are to be affordable. If you take 60% of that number, you'll get in the 3,000s, like 3,400 to 3,800 or something like that. So that's the amount. It's not the 58, in my opinion. And so how do we make those become affordable? Is that the question?
The question is, what would you say to the city of Bozeman speed up the process?
Well, first of all, how fast do you want new homes delivered? Do you want them delivered in a large scale soon? Or are you willing to go more slowly and let the problem get worse? So I would say what needs to really happen now that there is a action plan that has details in it and a roadmap in it, we get to this thing called development and construction. I believe, in my mind, that developers and finance people and designers and review and approval, city, and contractors, me, have to collaborate and come to terms with how quickly can we take an idea and take it from concept to move in. I think that that will only happen well if people can roll up their sleeves and figure out a way to really work together to solve the problem. Development is a risky business. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of unpredictability. It's not for everyone, for sure. So if you can make the timeline faster by getting together with all parties and get the input from those professional people and work together as a team with a common goal, and this may be seem a little unrealistic, but that's what I think. I think that that would be beneficial to our community if we could do that.
Thank you. So we are looking at just a slight different direction, but it has to do with seniors in our community. And so this is a Bozeman-based question, but I think it'd be interesting to hear what you have noticed from around the country as well. So what is being done in Bozeman for providing affordable housing for senior citizens? I know there's a waiting list now, and it's important to have housing close to city transportation. What have you seen, or what do you know?
I can tell you in Bozeman that there are several projects for seniors that are coming through the tax credit program. One of them is 30 units, and the other one is 120.
So there's an answer to whoever was asking that question, and I'm sure you'll be able to stick around, Phil, and if they have an additional question. Corianne, have you seen some experience around that issue, specifically around senior citizens?
And transportation. Yeah. You know, I think that it's obviously easier to build more near transportation routes, so that's a great place to put maybe the multifamily properties, particularly if you're talking about wanting to age in place and maybe needing to have some on-site services, which would be really handy to be able to just walk downstairs, for example, and access a physician or a nurse. I also think that we should think, of course, about older adults who want to age in their homes. They may be homeowners and have homes already, and think about how to, again, just ensure that access to services that folks might need, and what that looks like, whether that's the bus system here or or other ways to kind of fill those gaps in helping people get to where they need to go when they need a little bit more assistance to do that.
Okay. Andrew, this might be for you. What is the role of redistricting, zoning, it looks like partitioning requirements on the availability of affordable housing?
Sure. So, yeah, there are definitely opportunities to sort of make it easier to build faster, to make it easier to build smaller, to make it easier to build denser, all of which can reduce the cost of housing. You know, one example that I think has gotten a lot of attention lately is Minneapolis has basically done away with single-family zoning in large swaths of the city. There's a similar bill in Oregon to do it statewide that would allow by-right development. So basically, just sort of quick zoning primer for folks. Land gets sort of, lines get drawn on maps and cities decide, you know, you can build single-family houses here and you can build industrial uses here and you can build commercial uses here. Multifamily doesn't fit into the residential often. It's often, or it's a separate category of residential. But being able to build something other than a single family home on a decent sized lot is, you know, a way in which you can produce a lot more housing on the same amount of land. So more intensive use of land will raise the price of land, right? Because it's now worth more because you're producing more housing on it. But the per unit cost of the land will go down significantly. So that the ability to use land more intensely is really powerful. It often is met with a lot of community opposition, right? So the shorthand for that is not in my backyard, NIMBY. There's a countervailing movement now, yes, in my backyard, YIMBY. And those are acronyms, what can I tell you? But the you know, the truth is that small multifamily properties are often built in the scale of the surrounding neighborhood. So three stories, two stories, right? You've got a bunch of tall houses on your block. You wouldn't necessarily know if they had, you know, four units, six units, eight units, as opposed to just being a large house. And in fact, something that always strikes me thinking about kind of some national examples, Los Angeles, right, which is sort of like the poster child for like car culture and single family houses as far as the eye can see. The amount of small multifamily properties nestled in these single family communities that you would never notice if you weren't looking for them is unbelievable, because we've done a lot of research on small multifamily properties and who owns them and where they exist. Right, they're everywhere, but we don't think about it. And so being able to build that at that scale is really helpful in terms of producing a lot more units relatively quickly, because it's, you know, you can build three single family units, but you got to find three different parcels, right? But if I build a triple decker that can serve, each one of them serves a family, I've now produced it on a single lot, right? I don't have to have three utility hookups. I don't have to three, right? It's much easier to build slightly smaller units, but, you know, admittedly, but perfectly adequate, perfectly decent, perfectly safe, really fit units for people to live in. And so I think that making it easier to build at a neighborhood scale, right, sort of the shorthand now that's growing term for this is the missing middle. So something that fits in between single family properties and, you know, really large multifamily buildings, garden style apartments and the like, but really sort of at a scale that fits in with the community, that adds both a diversity to the community, not only in terms of the occupants, but also in terms of the price points, I think is really critical to addressing some of these challenges. So I think addressing it from both the land use, what's allowed by right to sort of speed up the development process, but also getting people to think about what it means to have these in their community and the benefits that they have. In fact, the reason why people often point to wanting to maintain single family zoning is that there's a fear that, well, if I get an apartment building on my block, the value of my house is going to go down. Tremendous amounts of research indicate that new multifamily construction actually raises nearby property values. And we've looked at this not only in the context of the low-income housing tax credit, right? So these are sort of subsidized affordable units. They raise prices nearby. So the value to the community, right, for the homeowner, from the homeowner's perspective, that, oh my God, I'm going to have renters living near me. Well, first of all, most renters actually live in 1 to 4 unit properties. That large apartment buildings are less than 10% of the rental stock. So there are renters everywhere. Someone earlier today, we were talking about the ownership versus rental split in Bozeman, and the city of Bozeman is majority renters anyway. So typically we think about land use policies being made by homeowners because in a lot of places, particularly suburban places, they're the majority, and so they kind of dictate what happens. But in a city where the majority of families are renting, the ability to build more rental housing should rise higher in the public consciousness and should be more doable.
Mm. Corianne, this may be for you. Are there any examples of growing desirable communities that have a good mix of housing prices reflecting local wages? And if so, how do they do it? It's a tough one.
There are, you know, I think it's really about understanding the market and timing. So I think we hear about those places that are really struggling and are really seeing a very weak market, losing population, losing residents. Not due to lack of housing supply, but maybe due to a lack of jobs in the community. And then we hear about the other end. We hear about those markets that just seem to be going crazy, you know, where housing prices have gone through the roof very quickly. There's a lot of communities in the middle, right? There's a lot of communities that, you know, aren't facing either of those extremes right now. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity in those places to kind of be mindful of what can change. And again, to proactively develop a variety of housing options. So, you know, cities that seem to be rather stable, perhaps, or maybe, you know, starting to fight increasing prices or starting to worry about a decline, you know, doing things like establishing a community land trust that I know Bozeman is looking into expanding right now to ensure that before significant changes happen, that some land is really reserved for community use at an affordable price, come what may. In terms of changes in the surrounding market, you know, to make sure that you're building kind of at multiple points in the market. And so I think that there's, a lot of places across the country that, you know, are living in the middle, not at those extremes, that, you know, provide a really good opportunity to think about ensuring that no matter what happens, there are options for everyone who want to live in the community.
Thank you. So the final question for tonight, for all three of you, and we'll start with Phil. Is there a step towards implementing affordable housing that has not been discussed, or would you like to reiterate something that has been discussed tonight?
Is there a step toward producing affordable housing? I think that's the question, and that's the way I look at it.
Could you repeat that again?
The way I react to that question is there another step to actually producing the housing, just planning it, but producing it? And I don't think there is an extra step. I think I would reiterate my earlier comments that we need to work together as a team to get it done.
Yeah.
There are a few steps along the way that municipalities have engaged in to try to force affordable housing to happen. And sometimes I feel like that's just putting more risk on the risk takers. I don't know if that's going to work very well here in our town. So I just think teamwork is really what it, to reach that goal, all the major stakeholders need to roll up their sleeves, get together, and figure out what they can do to make it work.
Thank you.
You know, I think a lot of what shapes local housing decisions are the perspectives of the constituents. And Andrew already mentioned, you know, how community perceptions can kind of influence the opportunities in the area. And so, you know, I think a critical next step is kind of reimagining who your neighbor is or can be, and just having an open mind that it could be anyone. You know, I think that there's a stigma associated with renters that we already talked about earlier. There's certainly stigma associated with certain individuals, certain families, maybe certain family structures, certain income levels, probably certain occupations, right? We carry a lot of categories in our minds, and we sort people. And I think that, you know, a healthy community is one that avoids sorting people and instead embraces everyone, acknowledging our shared humanity, and that housing really is a basic right, that everyone needs a safe, quality roof over their head in order to maximize their potential and ensure they have access to opportunity. And so I think that that's an important next step, is to, as a community, think through who is your neighbor, and acknowledge that it's probably a more diverse picture than you have in your mind's eye.
Thank you.
So I'm going to go, I guess, in a slightly different direction and sort of pick up on something that actually Corianne, I think, had mentioned early on in terms of the way in which the role of the federal government in all of this. And so we've spent a lot of time today talking about what happens in Bozeman and sort of the local response to local affordable housing needs. But again, Bozeman is not unique in the affordable housing challenges. There's basically no place in the country where, you know, a low-wage worker can afford the median rental unit. There's, you know, with the exception of sort of a small strip of counties going down the middle of the country, which have very, very low populations, the rate of cost burden for people who are basically paying more than 30% of their income for housing is more than one in five basically everywhere in the country. Mm. And so there's a real sort of national challenge, and I think it's important and it's valuable to look back to the federal government to say, well, how are we allocating all of these public dollars to support these social goals that we collectively really need to address? And so that means fully funding the housing voucher programs and other, you know, sort of block grant programs that make affordable housing production and rental subsidies available, expansion of the low-income housing tax credit, which is basically the only production tool that we have for dedicated affordable housing. So I think that, you know, going beyond just the, you know, the municipal boundaries of Bozeman or the state boundaries of Montana, use your voices not only to engage in the local conversation, but use your voices to talk to your representatives in Congress. You're fortunate enough to have informed members, and I think that, you know, bringing your voice not only to the local level, but bringing it up to the federal level and saying, this is a challenge even here. I mean, I will be honest with you, when I said, oh, I'm going out to Montana to talk about affordable housing, everybody's like, really? Montana? I'm like, yeah. Yeah, it's a problem everywhere. Mm. And so you shouldn't have to feel that you're doing this alone. And so I think bringing your voice to the larger conversation that's happening around this can be really powerful because, you know, those of us inside DC, you know, we hear from the same folks over and over again. And I think bringing new voices and new perspectives, but sort of recognizing that even with this, when the circumstances are different, the needs remain the same everywhere, I think, again, goes back to building a much broader and stronger constituency, so ensuring that these programs remain viable and valuable in the coming years. So
thank you. I want to build off your voices piece of it. I want to provide you a little bit more direction in terms of how to continue this conversation or to learn more. The first is tomorrow. There's a brown bag lunch at City Hall starting at 11:45 a.m., and you can learn more about the new Housing Action Plan. So that's tomorrow, 11:45 a.m. at City Hall, and feedback is welcome. The new housing plan will be presented to the City Commission on November 18th, and for 30 days there will be an opportunity for public comment, both online as well as at commission meetings, and any other way that you can provide feedback, I'm sure it will be accepted. So that's two direct and local ways to look at this new action plan. And then I would say that finally, I want to close the evening with some acknowledgments. First of all, the organizing committee of Symposium. Isn't this incredible that we have this opportunity for public discourse like this in our community, thanks to their work? Yeah. I'd like to thank our esteemed guest speakers, Dr. Corianne Payton-Scally, Andrew Jacobowitz, and Phil Rotherham for their expertise tonight and the willingness to provide us with the kind of depth around this question on both a regional and national level. Would you join me in thanking them? I'd be remiss if I didn't thank those students, the MSU students that are here in the group right now. They offered some great questions, as well as the students from the MSU Leadership Institute who welcomed you and collected all your questions tonight and actually helped put together this part of the program, the Carmen part of the program. So if you'll join me in thanking them. And most importantly, none of this would happen without the support of you, our community members, for making time tonight to hear about this important topic, ask what were really great questions. There were just a few questions. It looks like about five here that we didn't get to tonight. If your question wasn't answered, we will have a few minutes with our guest panelists tonight. We want to make sure that every question that was requested gets answered. So we're willing to stick around a little bit to answer those questions. And then finally, thank you for all the energy tonight, and we wish you a great evening. Thanks again.